Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm Ed Schneider, and this is a session on the theological roots of health care. So if that's where you want to be this hour, you're in the right place. Cotton Mather. See, one person is in the wrong place. Cotton Mather, the great Puritan preacher of New England, once described the combined practice of spiritual and physical healing as the angelical conjunction. Well, that might have been the case in the days of Mather, but I think in recent generations, the worlds of medicine on the one hand and healthcare, and on the other hand, the world of religion have become rather separate spheres. Our thinking and our life have tended to become compartmentalized, so that if we are physically sick, we go to a hospital and we expect the ministrations of people who've been trained in medical science and nutrition and all the other allied components which we collectively call the medical community. And on the other hand, if we are spiritually troubled or searching, we turn a corner toward another institution, the church, where we would expect the ministrations of somebody trained in theology. There's been a kind of tacit agreement between the official representatives of medicine and the church to accept a kind of neat division in human nature between body and soul, where the body is the territory of medicine and the soul is the territory of the church. Each of these can then in some way be thought to have a healing ministry, but the one is physical and the other is spiritual. With such a viewpoint, I think to talk about the theological roots of healthcare would probably be understood as meddling. However, I intend in my remarks this morning to stand with those who challenge this neat cleavage between body and soul, and who press for a more holistic view of what healthcare is about, though I recognize that the term holistic has been discredited in some circles by becoming a banner for all sorts of kooky approaches to healthcare. In our time together this morning, I want to talk about basically four things involved in healthcare from a theological point of view. The first thing I would like to say is that healthcare involves mending a broken creation. Healthcare involves mending a broken creation. I think this is what Jesus was about in his ministry. In the book of Mark, for instance, we read, and I quote, "And he called to him the 12 and began to send them out two by two and gave them authority over the unclean spirits. So they went out and preached that men should repent, and they cast out many demons and anointed with oil many that were sick and healed them." Likewise, we know that healing was an integral part of the ministry of the early church after the resurrection. In the fifth chapter of the book of Acts, for instance, we read, "And more than ever believers were added to the Lord, multitudes both of men and women, so that they even carried out the sick into the streets and laid them on beds and pallets, that as Peter came by, at least his shadow might fall on some of them. The people also gathered from towns around Jerusalem, bringing the sick and those afflicted with unclean spirits, and they were all healed." Healing was a manifestation of the power of God at work in the church. Now, let me be clear about that. I'm well aware that a vital faith in Jesus Christ was not and is not necessarily accompanied by physical or spiritual or mental well-being. Health is certainly relative, and in the normal sense of the word at least, temporary. Even in the New Testament accounts, one need go no further than the Apostle Paul to realize that faith and robust health are not always coexistent. But the point, I think, is that the healing ministry of Jesus and the early church gave evidence of what the kingdom of God is really all about. It was sort of a sign, namely that the kingdom of heaven is about the mending of the creation. Jesus was pushing back the frontiers of all of the forces of destruction. And this is what the work of the kingdom continues to mean. In the New Testament, the word that is used for save means to forgive sins, but the same word also means to heal. In English, we have two words, where the Greek only has one. And we've tended to separate these two, and we've devised two institutions to serve their needs, the church and the medical profession. But I think we need to re-examine the essential connectedness of salvation and healing. Thomas Draghi has put it this way. He said, Jesus both forgives and heals, but the two are for all practical purposes interchangeable. Where you expect him to heal, he forgives. And where you expect him to forgive, he heals. This is confusing to us, but only because of the sharp differentiations we make. Jesus simply heals the man, the whole man, and this includes both his sin and his illness, unquote. If health care means mending the whole creation, then I think we need to broaden our understanding of what is included in health care. Sickness certainly has to do with our physical body. But we can also be sick mentally, emotionally, and spiritually. We can be sick in terms of our relationships, or sick in terms of our value choices. There can be sickness in the family system, sickness in the social order. If health care means mending a broken creation, then we find this brokenness really everywhere around us. Again, Thomas Draghi put it in a very interesting way, I think. He says, quote, the term brokenness is an apt metaphor for defining illness as the malfunction of the entire created order. Language is instructive for grasping this, he continues. Medically, we speak of torn ligaments, bone fracture, perforation of the bowel, rupture of a blood vessel, detachment of a retina, lesions, dislocations, etc. More popularly, we talk about splitting headaches and split personalities. We talk about people with a broken heart or a broken spirit. People are cracking up or going to pieces or becoming unglued. All of these expressions, he says, connote brokenness, separation, division. Healthcare means mending a broken creation. In the perspective of the scriptures, health means wholeness, physical, mental, emotional, spiritual wholeness. And it involves not just individual wholeness, but social and institutional wholeness as well. So working for such wholeness, then, is what healthcare is all about. And I think that viewed from this perspective, the medical community then and the church can make common cause in mending this broken creation. Secondly, I would suggest that healthcare involves a concern our meaning. Healthcare involves a concern for meaning. Health requires some integrating principle, some meaningful orientation to our life. This was one of Viktor Frankl's observations in the prison camps of World War II. It was the people, he said, who had some meaningful orientation, who had some sense of hope, who survived in the concentration camps against tremendous odds. It was they who had some kind of a will to live. I suppose we have all known people who could endure great suffering if only they could find meaning somehow in it all. Norman Cousins has stated that our most important prescription is that provided by our own will, and that must be tied to some sense of meaning. Frankl has said, quote, "I think it is time to recognize the fact that man is more than just a mechanism or the outcome of conditioning processes, to recognize that man is a being in steady search of meaning, and that his heart is restless until he finds meaning in life," unquote. A brochure from a congregation in Minneapolis which sponsors a health care clinic puts it this way, and I quote, "We have found that bodily functions, or that bodily reactions, are affected toward better health and ability to cope with stress as people grow in faith in God, as people find meaning and purpose in life, as people make consistent moral and ethical choices, and as people adopt lifestyles and behaviors which are consistent with their beliefs," unquote. It's simply the case, in other words, that healthcare has to be concerned about meaning and about a sense of purpose in people's lives. Every person has to organize their life around some principle. A person's life has to be integrated around some sense of an ultimate concern. From a Christian point of view, that ultimate concern cannot be derived just from within ourselves. Rather, our need for meaning is understood as a testimony to our need for a relationship with God, who is the source and the ground of all life and wholeness. For Christians, that relationship to God is made concrete in the person of Jesus, who is both the norm or the standard of what it means really to be whole, and also the source of wholeness in the lives of those who follow him. If there is no wholeness, no health, without a sense of meaning and purpose, then health care, in whatever form we might want to look at it, cannot avoid a concern for meaning in the lives of people. Thirdly, I think that health care, from a theological perspective, involves tapping resources of grace and community. Tapping resources of grace and a community, and community. In a sense, this is merely another piece of the task of mending a broken creation. We've long since learned theologically that all illness is not related to some specific sin. But it is also true that much dis-ease is self-inflicted. One writer says, quote, "The way in which we abuse our bodies, through what we eat and drink, through the stresses we subject ourselves to, through the failure to get the proper amount of exercise and sleep, are signs of our irresponsibility as caretakers of the good gifts of creation. Thus, dis-ease is a reminder of our need for repentance as well as healing, unquote. The point is that our health or illness is often related to our sense of self-worth. Many stress-related illnesses stem from the notion that one's self-worth is earned, often in competition with others. At another level, somatic or physical symptoms can sometimes be understood as what someone has called the amplified and distorted voice of conscience, bearing witness to some violation of a person's values, and so that comes out in symptoms of stress and so on. The knowledge that one's worth comes from as the gift of a gracious God is therefore both liberating and also health-producing. The church makes a significant contribution to health when it leads an individual to accept himself or herself and other persons in the context of an ultimate acceptance by God. It's out of this self-acceptance that persons can develop the motivation to accept responsibility for their health and to develop then a healthy lifestyle. But while this may be an individual benefit of one's personal faith, it's not something, I think, that happens in a kind of individualistic vacuum. It happens when people know themselves to be part of a grace-formed religious community. The church, as a grace-formed community itself, serves as a healing community. There's some rather interesting questions which deserve exploring, I expect, in this regard. Why, for instance, is the incidence of cancer roughly half the expected rate among Seventh-day Adventists? Or why do blood pressure values vary predictably in accordance with adherence to or non-adherence to orthodoxy among the Amish? Why is there such little alcoholism among those of the Jewish faith? Whatever specific connections there may be in these instances, we know that an accepting community where people are free to confess their failings and to make themselves vulnerable has a healing effect on those who are part of that community. For such a community simply to exist is in itself, of course, a miracle of grace. And I suspect that most of our congregations have not taken seriously their potential in this respect. Finally, I want to suggest that healthcare, from the perspective of Christian theology, involves the proclamation the cross and resurrection. Now that may seem a bit far-fetched, but I would want to contend that the very core of the Christian message is relevant to the way in which we understand health and healthcare. The cross and the resurrection, I would contend, serve to put our concern for health in its proper perspective. Once more, let me quote Draghi. He says, quote, "Together, the cross and resurrection provide a distinctive vantage point from which to understand healing. The cross judges any view that accords health the highest value in life, for death is the end of such health. The resurrection judges any view that does not see beyond illness, failure, and defeat, because the health that comes from God is the end of death, and the promise of eternal life, which is underneath even the dying that cannot be stopped, by the most sophisticated methods of modern science, unquote. The cross and the resurrection, in other words, remind us that even health, as we normally regard it, is not the supreme value in life. Draghi continues, the health and wholeness to which Jesus called people was not simply restoration of function or restored equilibrium or the elimination of the symptoms of disease. He invited people to a life of love and service to both God and man. Nothing less than that counts for health. See, a bigger perspective on what health is really all about. This is the significance of Jesus asking his followers to take up his cross. Willingness to sacrifice one's life for others is the supreme example of what Jesus means to be whole. This is the significance of Jesus saying that whoever would save his life will lose it, and whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel's will save it. The resurrection reminds us that even death cannot finally undermine this wholeness which God promises to his children. It points us to the final mending of the creation. And it reminds us also, I think, that we serve his kingdom when we care for the health of all people. Well, let me stop with that for the moment and pick up whatever comments and questions you might have. I have a little grid that I want to share with you a bit later on, but first let's stop here and see what kinds of observations or questions you might have. Yes?
With the patients that I've worked with as a therapist, I have often seen that those who understand the message of the resurrection the best are often the most disabled. We have no hope of physical mending to its fullness, but we have instead a much deeper appreciation for the wholeness that Jesus offers.
Which says something about what we have always said in terms of our theology, namely that there is no resurrection without a cross. Huh? That it is really in the when the cross becomes something that we personally experience, not in the terms of a martyr complex or masochism, but in terms of understanding the cross that's laid upon us, that it doesn't come to us because we choose it. If we can understand God's grace, God's judgment and grace operating through that, then the resurrection becomes more meaningful. There's no resurrection without a cross, in our personal experience also.
I was touched last night when Elma Witt said Jenny was cured.
Yes. Cured by death. Not just cross, though, but cross and resurrection. Yes.
The scriptures talk about when people need healing, why the church should anoint with oil, call the elders together, and why is the church not using that down here?
I think part of it is what I alluded to at the beginning, that we have separated this body and soul business, and we've said that the church exists to care for the soul, the care and cure of souls, and we have allowed a science and medicine to institutionalize the care and cure of the body, the physical. And we've made that sort of dichotomy, that separation between body and soul. And we have forgotten, really, what is the biblical view that we are whole persons. We can talk about different dimensions of a person's existence, but you really cannot pull them apart and separate them somehow. And, we're learning that all over again, even by through such things as psychosomatic illness and that kind of thing. Paul?
I appreciate much of what you said under point four and being able to hear it in this context, because I certainly notice a difference between people who understand the cross's judgment on health as the highest good when death is imminent.
Yeah.
And am exasperated sometimes by dealing with medical institutions that seem not willing to allow a person to die.
Yeah.
And I think that that is a point at which health has become idolatrous.
Yeah. Yeah.
And yet in that situation, it's very, very difficult to deal with both the emotions, the intense emotions, and also the theological underpinning.
The terminally ill person who's perhaps has lost, is no longer conscious, will never be conscious, but is medically kept alive somehow beyond all compassionate concern, because death represents only defeat. And you know, I think we have to be very understanding of doctors and nurses and those all who work in the medical profession, because they are constantly dealing with this notion that death is a failure on their part, unless they've been able to move somehow through that to the notion of resurrection.
Can I just share one instance?
Please.
That was very compelling. It happened nearly 2 years ago, but I haven't quite gotten over it yet. It was a woman who was severely diabetic, who was in need of 4 heart bypasses, and who was starting to experience kidney failure. They attempted dialysis, and the kidney dialysis failed. It didn't take, which meant that eventually her kidney failure was going to kill her. At that point, they asked her if she wanted, she was still conscious, if she wanted bypass surgery. She chose not to have surgery. But because they put her on a heart pump, she lived for several days after that. And even after consciousness was gone, the doctors kept offering to call in the surgical team to do the heart bypass surgery. The family was just tormented with that decision over and over and over again. It was helpful in as much as their mother had chosen not to have the operation in the first place. But even that decision was kept before them so long, it's just wrenching.
Okay, let me just pick up one tiny piece of what you said there at the end. You said it was easier for them because their mother had...
Yeah.
They knew that this was... You see, the whole matter of dealing with guilt on the part of family members who finally have to make some of those decisions, if there is a perspective of cross and resurrection that is shared, a faith perspective that says there is something beyond, it seems to me that the guilt is easier to deal with. Yes?
Well, you know, that question is something that I have really struggled with because I went through something like this that this young man is related with my mother, where I had been very close to my parents and I knew what their desire was. But when she was in the last stages of her life, with these, what I felt were terrible things happened to her and did not preserve the dignity or anything. It was the worst experience of my life. And so I was so tormented by that I wrote a letter, and I did it in as loving a way as possible, to the doctor, the young doctor who I think did feel that, as you described, that it was a failure on his part if he could not, he said as much to me,
mm-hmm.
when I begged him not to do what he was doing, and he just brushed me aside. And so I wrote a letter to him, and then I wrote a letter to the hospital board, and I received explaining how I felt, and I felt everything was done was not in the context of my mother's faith and her belief in her life and what she expected afterwards. So the president of the board wrote me a letter back, and it was a most interesting letter because he supported everything that I had said. But then he made the statement that these questions the board was struggling with, and that there seemed to be no easy or simple answers. It was as though he was expressing their conflicted feelings. And I just wondered, you know, what we as Christians, you know, what is our, what can we do to intervene in that? And
see, one of the real problems, dilemmas that we face in this kind of situation, I think, is that we are not at all clear in our society who is responsible for making decisions about this kind of thing. And there, I think there are no easy answers. We could say, well, the patient ought to make decisions if they're able, but oftentimes they're not able. They're unconscious or something else, or sometimes they're in a situation which so distorts their judgment. I think, for instance, of burn victims who often are in such excruciating pain that they might want to die, but those who care for them know that that's a temporary situation, that they can be brought through it. Well, if not the patient, then who? The doctor, because the doctor has presumably the most medical knowledge. Well, medical knowledge in itself doesn't make one responsible for another person's life. These kinds of decisions, I think. Who then? Nearest of kin, relationship, relatives. Well, often. What about the case, though, of two spouses who've hated each other all their life? Would you then want your spouse to be the one to make that decision? What I'm saying is, we've not settled the question of who's responsible, and it's very difficult to try to settle that. I think the best thing we can probably say is that normally it ought not to be just a single person's decision. We ought to involve the doctor, the relatives, the chaplain if they want, or pastor, those who are involved somehow closely with the life of that person, so that the decision can be made together. I would think that's the ideal.
Do you suppose that we could write down these people that we trusted? Because in our church, we wrote down about our burial service and things that we'd like if we should die. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was I don't know who's going to look at those, but they're at our church, so that if something ever happened to us, they would know what we wanted, and maybe the people who we trust or would like to make decisions for, maybe that would be a good thing, because you can't foresee all the situations that would ever happen to you, but maybe the people that you would trust, that might be a good way.
Yeah, there are, of course, living wills, that are of dubious legal value, but they can be of some other value, I think, Michelle.
I really like to stress the importance of dialoguing with the variety of people that are involved in those kinds of decisions. I think many times doctors do need to hear not just the, I don't want you to do this, they need to hear the whys, and they need to hear a little more than a sentence or two. I think they certainly have something to learn, as does maybe the other supporting medical staff. In the same way, there are times where the family needs to hear messages. I'm thinking not so much of a terminal illness, but often in situations of nursing homes where families in a loving way are a hindrance to what the staff is trying to do in terms of helping that person maximize their potential at that point in time. And the family will say, why don't you just let them sit in the wheelchair? And the staff,
you're talking about exercise first,
walking and keeping them self-sufficient as long as possible, feeding themselves and things like that. So there's a really immense need for dialogue, whys and wherefores, on both sides.
Yes.
I think now you find many people going to classes on death and dying, and in these classes they stress often a dialoguing, and I'm in nursing, and in the hospital when people are quite ill, many, many, many doctors, there's a positive side to this, will call in the family and ask them who else they would like to call in, and they have one and sometimes two and three conferences as the patient either is going down or is coming back up again. What can we do? So it's a wholeness in that area. That's a good thing. I wonder now, second question. Why, since we know this, in training our clergy, why don't we stress this and make them feel comfortable working in this area and also the medical profession?
We're getting more and more of this training, I think, in seminaries for with clinical pastoral education kinds of experiences. But it occurs to me as you speak that oftentimes the most critical kinds of illness are handled in like teaching hospitals and so on, where there is no, where there's not necessarily a primary care physician involved with the family. And that complicates the situation because often there is no one doctor to whom you can go to relate and ask questions. I know in my own, I'll give you a personal experience. Some years ago I had a radical surgery. But I was at a university hospital, and when I finished with the surgery, there wasn't anybody really that I could go back to and ask questions about. I had met the surgeon for the first time when I was sedated outside the operating room. And he was in my room once after that for about 1 minute with a retinue of interns and so on. There was another person who had made the basic diagnosis, but I never saw him again. I mean, there was a resident who probably actually did the surgery. There were all of these people, but there was nobody really that I could go to even, and I mean, I wasn't terminal. I'm still around. But there was not the possibility for the kind of relationship where you can deal with the questions and have the kind of dialogue that's ideal. So that complicates it, I think. When we're really in tough situations, we're often in that kind of setting where it's less possible.
A very positive manifestation I see that I'm involved in back in my hometown is the hospice movement. And I have noticed, I myself have worked in a paramedical field as an x-ray temp, have seen the dehumanization in the hospitals. And a lot of the people involved in hospice are of that kind, nurses.
Sure.
Yeah. I feel like I'm doing God's work.
Yes.
I see very strong theological roots there.
Work with seminary students and so forth, mostly been in the psychological or psychiatric area, mental health rather than anything scientific. Separation still seems to be quite complete as far as treating the body from a medical standpoint.
Yeah, although I'd say there is increasing dialogue and there is increasing recognition of some of the things that I've tried to say here, that one's spiritual health affects one's physical health, to put it in those terms, and vice versa.
Well, the thing I was wondering, seems that the mental health area, which doesn't threaten life immediately, is still controversial enough or not defined so that even the doctors can't make the right statements, but they feel that they can. The other area, which
I see what you're saying. You're saying there, from the medical perspective, there is something sort of concrete about forms of physical illness.
Then you read statistics like 27% of medical costs are spent in the last 6 months of people's lives. That's counting Medicare. Now that means that they're speeding up the cost as you approach debt. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know what answer you could come up with for that. So it's an economic plus a scientific problem versus these others that are not so cut and dry.
Yeah. Yes.
I'm on the board of directors for a convalescent hospital sponsored by the Lutheran Church in our area. And I don't think people are really aware of how responsible the home is to the laws of the state of California. They have to keep people living. And they have to go by the laws. And I realize what Barbara's saying when you get these letters from people. But until we go and change the laws, the homes do have to abide by them.
Mm-hmm. So the legal vulnerability is one piece of the puzzle.
Right.
I would think that it is that it is intensified in the kind of situations that I described earlier, where you do not have the primary relationship with a particular physician.
Right. I think in addition to that is the whole business of the rise in malpractice suits, and that physicians are forced into a corner by society that they must try every last thing.
So that later they can't, somebody can come and say, yeah, but you didn't do this test or this test, which could have been done. That's right. So someone else had a...
I think that everybody should have a lead for a will, living will, because it makes it a lot easier for the doctor and for the family and for the hospital. And
it makes it easier for the family. It may make it easier for the doctor. I'm not so sure about the hospital board because of what's been said over here. Because these living wills often do not have legal standing.
But in a lot of states now, excuse me, more and more states that have it as a legal.
What do you do
to make your will legal then? I feel I'm very fortunate. I have a practicing Christian doctor. He's been my doctor for many years, and he brought me through cancer surgery 4 years ago and other surgeries before. And I have an understanding with him, and with my family. That isn't enough. You still have to have a living will.
That may be the best. You may have a kind of ideal situation where you have a long-range relationship with your physician and an understanding with your family. Maybe as ideal as we're able to achieve. Somebody else over here.
Ed, do you want to bring up the practice of Christian Science in this area? Or?
I don't know a lot about Christian Science, except...
I don't either that much, but...
Yeah. Except...
We've had several good friends that, the practitioners say, that was your past sins and that, and there's nothing you can do about it. They don't even recognize it, and these people just pass away without any...
At bottom, the Christian Science, of course, does not acknowledge the reality of physical. The physical is really an illusion of some sort. It's not really real. And of course, that is fundamentally contrary to Christian theology, which underscores the reality of the body and of the physical, first of all, through creation, and secondly, through incarnation, and thirdly, through resurrection of the body. All of those things serve in Christian theology to underscore that the physical is not just something ephemeral or illusory, but it's really real. It's us. And Christian Scientists, I believe, would not acknowledge that at bottom. What's really real is only the spiritual, is only the mental, emotional, etc. And that's falling off the fence on the other side. And I suppose we all have stories of people who have suffered tragic consequences as a consequence of that bad theology.
I wonder if I might witness to what happened to me.
Please.
I'll make it short because it's a long story. But they found that I had an astrocytoma number 2, which is a tumor in my brain. And they expected me to die within 3 months. I went back to my neurosurgeon, and I wasn't dead for 2 months. And during all this time, I was speaking. I did have someone to talk to, and this was my physician, MD. And so he said, I'm praying for you, Mike. And he was not a Christian. And he says, anytime you've got a problem, you call me. No matter if it's day or night, I'll talk to you. And the neurologist said, you come back at 6 months. And if you're here, 6 months, I came back. Nothing had happened. And he says, I don't understand this. Because you are an astrocytoma number 2. He says an astrocytoma number one, they don't even know they've got a tumor in the brain. And number two says that you're going to go on to the three, and by the time you get four, you aren't anymore. Okay? But it didn't go on to the three. And he couldn't understand that. And this went on for a while until my personal physician said, there's something about the mind that I don't have. And then he told me, Mike, I'm going to go on a vacation down the Oregon coast. And I'm going to take a Bible, which he never looked into. And when he came back, he was a Christian. In the meantime, they wrote my record up in the medical journals because it had never, ever happened before that an astrocytoma, any number, lived. And I feel it's because of all this you have on the board here. I was concerned when he told me I was going to die. It didn't bother me at all. It bothered my children. And he told me what all I was going to go through. The first would be I would lose my ability to converse or language. And the kids were trying to get me to learn how to do sign language. I said, you don't understand. I won't understand what you're saying. And you can't make me understand what you're doing. Well, that really brought him down. And there was all kinds of crying going on in my house. So, I went to the kennel. Not the kennel. Where do they take animals when they don't want them anymore? And I got a cat. We didn't have one. But the cat took their mind off of me.
Yeah.
And then my first daughter comes to me and they said, Mama, I'm going to get married. We're going to have a baby right away. I said, don't do that. Not for me. Everything turned out all right. I couldn't have a baby. But it was... Forgive me, please.
It's all right.
Everybody wanted to hear my story. I had to go to the hospital for chemotherapy. And people in my church were fighting to drive me in. It was beautiful.
Community.
It was really beautiful. Here I am today. This was 4 years ago. God has really blessed me and my family.
Now let me tie that again to what Elmer Witt was saying last night. He was talking about loneliness, isolation. Isolation, I think, is one of the worst kind of factors for dis-ease, to cause unhealth, if you will. It's the opposite of community, isn't it? And we're in that struggle between isolation, loneliness on the one hand, and a sense of community on the other. It's the communities, it's the community stuff that has the healing potential. Isolation has the potential for breaking us down.
Do you know what I felt when he said you're going to die? I felt, oh good, I get to see my grandpa, my pastor. You know, I had a very positive feeling about it. It just didn't bother me. It bothered other people. It didn't bother
again,
me.
The communion of saints that transcends the present. Yeah. The community, that's what, you know, the communion of saints really means. We're in a community that extends back in time.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing.
I know a Christian psychologist, he's a Catholic in Billings, Montana, who said that until he learned to use Christian principles in his practice, nobody got well. And he started following the admonition of Paul, rejoice evermore, in everything give thanks. And he says now his patients get well.
One of the things I would suggest you might want to do is to read the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 9, the first 8 verses, the healing of the paralytic. You remember the story? They brought the paralytic to Jesus, and what did he do? What did he do first?
Your sins are forgiven.
Your sins are forgiven. And that rather blew their mind, probably for 2 reasons. First of all, because it was unexpected. They brought him to have him healed, not to have his sins forgiven. But secondly, of course, it blew their minds because only God was supposed to be able to forgive sins, and here this guy Jesus does it. But you see the connection? Forgiveness reestablishes a sense of relationship. Forgiveness reestablishes a relationship with God, as forgiveness reestablishes a relationship between persons. It creates the community. That's why I said the community is itself a miracle of grace, because it is based upon this bedrock kind of forgiveness that we believe is central to our faith. And when that happens, we are moving in the direction of wholeness and healing. See the connection between what happens at the very core of our faith when we talk about forgiveness of sin and our physical well-being.
We recently attended a service, a healing service, and it's interesting how he did what you said. He said, now before any person is able to receive a healing, you have to forgive whoever, and you have to forgive yourself. Then, if you want to ask for healing, the potential is there.
The one problem that I have with some of those occurrences is that it's pictured as automatic. That somehow, if you do this, then you will be healed of whatever the physical problem is. There's no promise like that in the scriptures, I don't think. In fact, if the paralytic had received the forgiveness of sins and had not gotten up to walk, he would have still been healed in the sense of been moved in the direction of wholeness. And that's the case of many, many people. Yeah. Many people who never overcome the physical disease, and as we know, all of us ultimately are, you know, death. Life is terminal for 100% of us. I always said that. I have to revise that a little bit this morning because Ray Martin reminded me, you know, that Paul did say that some are going to still be alive when Christ comes again. So maybe not 100%. It's possible we won't, but I'm not banking on that. Paul.
Ed, I like the complete reference of the book that you were quoting throughout your presentation. Was it Draghi?
Thomas Draghi, Droege, and I've gotten some of his stuff from 2 sources. One is a booklet that he himself wrote, and I am sorry I can't give you the title of it right now. The other, he is also quoted, and it's basically the same kind of material, in a book by Granger Westberg, and let's see, I think I have the title of that one here. Okay, the one by Draghi is entitled Ministry to the Whole Person. And the one by Granger Westberg is called The Theological Roots of Holistic Healthcare. Well, our time is up. So we'll call time for today. Thank you for your discussion.